He's sole author of, co-author of many other books, but sole author of the book Defense or Delusion, The American Military in the 1980s. He's presently consultant to the Secretary of Energy. He was the assistant director of the Arms Control and Disarmament Unit for Multilateral Affairs, 1984 to 86, and he has served as professor of strategy at the Naval War College. I think his interests in containment and defense policy and security represent another dimension, although not a conflicting one, with some of the presentations that we've had earlier. It's a great pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. Norman knows what stock I come from, and so he knows that as a minister's son, I cannot begin without a text. Meister Eckhart, who was a 13th century German mysticist, I guess one should say, said, "In silence, one can best preserve one's integrity." Now, you all know that in our business, it doesn't work that way. And so you are constantly torn between saying what needs to be said and putting yourself on the line, right? So, in this friendly gathering, I'm going to put myself on the line, all right? I've been asked to talk rather broadly about what's the strategic agenda, as I see it, and I'd like to share a few thoughts with you on that. And I would like to be relatively brief so that we can talk together rather than, I mean, I know what I'm going to say. It'll bore the hell out of me if that's all I hear. So let me get through that real quick, and then we can talk about what's going on out there as you see it, and you can ask for the things I inadvertently or deliberately left out. Between now and the turn of the century, one very important thing is going to happen. We in the Soviets are going to work out some idea of strategic stability, whatever that means. It remains to be defined. But it is becoming the operative concept. They don't want any more surprises than they've had recently. We don't like surprises very much either. The two of us have more and more in the way of shared interests, fewer and fewer in the way of direct conflicts of interest, although by no means none. And this is going to be the agenda. And I guarantee you that with Brent in the NSC, it's going to be worked on very hard in the next few years. It's a tremendously important step. We've spent the last 25, 30, 40 years even having an idea of strategic stability that depended on one simple idea, which was the limitation of Soviet influence outside the borders of the Soviet Union. That's what containment means. I think it continues to be in our interest to limit Soviet influence outside Soviet borders. But it is not within our ability to do so in the ways that we did and in the extent that we did in earlier years. So we are going to have to arrive at some new modalities and some new understandings. We're going to have to start thinking about the connection between central strategic relationships and regional affairs in ways that we haven't done before. Now, there are a couple of interesting dimensions to this. There are more than a couple. Is that an understatement? But let me call your attention to a couple, and I'd be willing to talk about any others that occur to you. We are, for the first time since those wonderful late 1940s, when we did have people who thought globally, and we did have people who had fought a war on two fronts, and who knew how to plan, and who knew that our interests were related on both sides of the big waters. We've gone through that generation. They're gone. We've had the little men in between. And we're now up against, once again, the need to have an integrated way of thinking about what's going on around the world. So one of the most important things, it seems to me, about this idea of stability, and the reason that I'm personally spending a great deal of my time on the Asian side of things right now, is that we have to find a way to take into account that the Soviet-American relationship, the central strategic relationships, are not defined by or confined to the European axis. In addition, we are seeing very clearly, some of us are anyway, that some of the problems that we see in Asia and some of the problems that we see in Europe are more alike than not. Part of it has to do with this emerging new economic order. I hate that term. It's one that the Third World coined in order to borrow money from us. You know that. But what we are seeing quite clearly is that some of the things we have to deal with in the Pacific and some of the things that we have to deal with in Europe are similar. We need to understand how similar and how different. It's going to take a little while and a lot of work to get that clear in our minds, because we are not really well in touch with that right now, quite honestly. We've been tending to deal with Beijing as if China was a special case. We look at the ASEAN states, and we analyze their economies and their politics. We imagine that somehow development and assistance in that part of the world has nothing to do with development and assistance elsewhere. So we have the Asian Development Bank, for example. And what's really happening is, I think, over the last couple of decades, a massive failure of coordination because people weren't up to thinking through the connections. It has to change. It will change as we work through this issue of stability. So my first subpoint then, very simply, is this. Some of our concerns in Asia and some of our concerns in Europe are more connected than we have been used to thinking about. And we have to deal with that more effectively and more deliberately as we go on. A few of us are going to try. A second point. We all know this is a very educated and distinguished group. So I won't belabor the obvious. I will simply restate for reference at the moment. We all know that what power is and how you exercise it is changing. We can have all this, the literature is full of it, I don't need to say it except once, and that is that there is a changing relationship now between the relative effectiveness of military versus, or as opposed to, or as contrasted with, economic power. It is now possible to be politically influential without having any military capabilities whatsoever. Case in point, Taiwan, one of the strongest economies in the world, number 11 at the moment in terms of total size, much higher than that in terms of current account surpluses and reserves. They have 24 destroyers, all vintage, believe me, and they're lucky they can even keep them afloat. I can say that with a straight face. I've just been there, and I've been there many times, and the admiral in command of the fleet is a former student of mine. And I know exactly what their situation is. It's desperate. If you look at the countries in Asia, there is not a single one, apart from the Soviet Union, which I count as an Asian power, and apart from ourselves, which I also count as an Asian power, there is not another country in Asia that can project power beyond its borders to any significant degree. Vietnam has been fooling around in Kampuchea, but you can walk there. And that, as far as I'm concerned, doesn't count. So when you look at things like that, and then you look at the next generation, you look at these vibrant economies that literally hold part of our future in their hands, you begin to get the idea, at last, that there is a changing relationship between economic and military factors. We are not just at the end of the first post-war Cold War period. We are finally reaching what my friend Walt Rostow would call the hypertrophy of imperialism. In other words, we've gone farther than we should have. It's very simple, to bottom line. being a great power is not as much fun as it used to be. And the sooner we come to grips with that, the better off we're going to be. Now, that being said, a third small entry under this general topic. The fact that it's not fun anymore, and the fact that the power relationships are changing in some interesting ways, does not mean that we don't have any interests at stake, and it does not mean that we don't have any responsibilities. That's the hard part. That's where the real thinking has to be done, because all I've said so far is real easy. I mean, you can come to grips with that intellectually pretty much like that. The hard part starts when you say, okay, now that it's harder than it used to be and not much fun, now that things are changing on us, what still matters and what do we do about it? Well, I think there are a few things that still matter. And a few things for which we will have to try to make a difference, however hard it is and however imperfect the results are. One thing that matters is that there are a number of very fragile Asian and African and European democracies out there. And they need our support. They need our steadying influence. They need, I hate to use this term, it sounds like Kipling all over again, but it's not. They do need a little bit of guidance from time to time. But most of all, they need the confidence to persist, to persevere, in spite of severe domestic difficulties. The greatest threat to strategic stability, in regional terms, is the absolute fragility of so many of these governments and institutions. I'm not worried about the Soviets coming out and doing funny things in Indonesia or in the Philippines. I'm worried about the collapse of the ability to govern. These people need our help. They need our consistent attention, our encouragement, from time to time some aid, and one hell of a lot of good advice. Americans are good at advice, by the way. Sometimes less good at other things. That counts. We can't lose sight of that. Another thing that counts is that we do have to help manage the changing economic structure out there. We have a lot at stake, for one thing. But we are still the world's most powerful economy, and we will be well into the next century. Maybe through the next century. Nobody knows where the Japanese are going to top out. I think the Japanese are frankly bent on doing themselves an injury in the near future. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if by the turn of the century they had made some political errors that injured their ability to expand economically. Is that a nice way to say it? So, you know, it's not altruism that I'm talking about. We have interests. And we need to keep that in mind, too. We've got a lot to protect. And the third small entry I would make is that we in the Soviets still don't have, really, a shared understanding of how to cooperate in dealing with all these new factors out there. I think with Gorbachev, there's a lot of enthusiasm and some hope that things can be different than they were before. There's also some reason to believe that he may not be a survivor in the Soviet system. And in any case, you cannot count on individuals to be the answer to structural problems. And that was a bit, recall now, Germany's problem in the late 19th century was not that it got unified and not that it got powerful. It was that only one guy could make the system work. And when Bismarck was gone, Germany went down the wrong road. I'm being polite. I'm used to talking to military audiences this way. You can't afford too much genius. That means you have to have simple systems that are difficult for idiots to fool with. And we are a long way in dealing with the Soviets from coming up with stability concepts that will exist and that will persist in spite of the fools who are bound to come along. So we've got a lot of work to do. And I just want to remind you as we go along that Glasnost and Perestroika are wonderful. Soviet TV is getting better, by the way. I was there not long ago, again. And it is getting better, but it's still not very good. I like Gorbachev. By the way, he is one of the world's most natural, gifted, born politicians that you'll ever find. This guy is good. No matter what country in the world he'd been born in, he could be in office. He is really good. He is close, he's warm, close up. He's everybody's uncle. And that's how he works the crowd. It's just like your uncle. It's beautiful to see. And the people respond to him. I've watched him real close up. And he treats his colleagues with that calm combination of authority and care. And Norman, you know what powerful combination that can be. I hope very much that it'll be around for a while, but his being around is not the answer to the structural problems in Soviet-American relations. That's simply the point. We have a lot of work to do to make this idea of stability a reality. We have a lot to do to extend our understanding of what interests we share and which we don't. We have a lot to do to define the ways in which we're going to deal with the things on which we do not share interests and on which we do disagree. And there are plenty of those left. And we're a long way from dealing with the military dimensions of this relationship in entirely satisfactory terms. You know, announcing unilateral cuts of 500,000 men in conventional forces when you have 5 million men under arms and you don't know whether they're coming out of the engineer corps or the logistics or the frontline combat troops is nothing. I don't care how many tanks he takes out of Europe, I care which ones. And they know that. They're not stupid. So we've just got to be real cautious at this point. Not in the sense of doing nothing. Not in the sense of making no reciprocal gestures, not in the sense of failing to explore every opportunity that they seem to present. But we have to be very, very careful as to what is the substance and the result of what we get. You know, the president said in 1982, in his first speech to the UN, that we ought not to confuse the signing of agreements with the solving of problems. I thought that made a lot of sense. And I think we need more than ever to keep that in mind. There are a lot of other things going on in the world, and I could talk longer than you could listen, I'm sure, because after all, I get paid to talk. Like all us professors, right? But I'd like simply to sum up by saying stability is the idea. We in the Soviets now agree on that as an agenda. We need other people to agree that it is a good agenda, such as the Japanese, the Chinese, one or two other states. And quite truly, there's only three or four states in the world that count when you come to this level of concern. And we need to develop the modalities and define the terms so that we can deal with regional issues, shifting power relationships, adjustments between economic and military factors in a context that we all understand. If we can share the framework, we can deal with the disagreements within it. If we can't share the framework, each of the disagreements in itself is going to be a serious problem. So I really think that we have a decade's work cut out for us. I know that George Bush and Brent Scowcroft and others will try very hard in the next few years to make some progress on these points. And I really think that because our system permits such a wide-ranging interchange between those in office and those in academia and those in industry, that we can all help. So, as Lyndon Johnson used to say, let's reason together. Let's think together. Let's work together. Questions, comments, arguments.
Okay. You want to talk to a military audience? You got one. First and foremost, Wendell Willkie will thank you very much for his prescience never recognized in his day, one word. And I'm impressed with what you're saying. It's been long overdue. And secondly, what advice would you give the president regarding do we need a V-2? Do we need a four big battle wagons that are manned up to the teeth? And do you need those divisions in the United States, not those that are in Europe?
Yeah.
They should stay, but can you get rid of five divisions in the United States, disband them? Can you put the B-2 on hold? Can you stuff those battle wagons back into the mothballs they came out of? What would you do?
I would do this to respond directly. First of all, the forces are going to shrink in the coming years. There's no doubt about that. The active forces are going to get smaller. We are already, in fact, doing that. So are the Soviets. We are replacing systems with more expensive units and fewer of them. Everything you can look at. We bought 744 B-52s. We're talking about buying 132 of the B-1s, and the buy on the B-2 is classified. So I can't tell you that. You should probably know. Anyway, what we're doing, and we're doing it in submarines, we're doing it with tanks, we're doing it with infantry units. It's all getting more expensive, fewer in number, and the Soviets are doing the same thing. So, in fact, both sides are going to have smaller forces. Now the question is this going to be done intelligently and with purpose, or is it going to be done piece by piece, budget line by budget line, in some kind of stupid, ordinary, incremental way? I have to say, I fear the latter, but I would like to help with the plumber. I think we can safely hold the B-2 for a while. I think when the cuts in the active forces start to get severe, in spite of what you've just said, the first cuts are going to come in overseas forces. You may be wrong, but that's how it's going to happen. Partly because of the political pressure on us overseas. We have to understand that while those people want us there, they don't exactly like us being there. And so we're hearing now, for example, in the last 2 weeks from South Korea, I think this was reported in the papers, but if not, I will be happy to confirm it. We've had the first request from the South Koreans since the Korean War to reduce the size of our forces there.
And move your headquarters.
That's right. Well, they want it. They want the command, of course. They've wanted that for years. And they'll get it eventually. I even think they should have it. I'd like for them to spread I'd like to spread the blame a little bit. Why not let them carry some of the load? But we are going, all these things are going to happen. So the only question then is what is, see, that comes back to the core issue of what's changing between military and economic power. The question that you have to ask yourself is, what difference does it make to your influence and your interests when your military forces get smaller? We don't know the answer to that question. Not enough people are asking it. But I'm not going to quit asking it. I guarantee it. We need to understand that a whole lot better than we do now. And so that's, that's really the critical issue as far as I'm concerned. The budget issue is very, very clear. We're going to see smaller forces. We're going to see changes from active forces into reserve forces. And whole lots of other things. The ground forces are going to get a lot smaller. The naval forces are going to stay pretty much where they are. I don't care whether the battleships are out or not, as long as they float. In fact, I kind of like them because they have a lot of armor on the deck. And in the days of cruise missiles and stuff like that, that's not a bad thing. So all I can say is that we are going to have uneven but clear reduction in forces on both sides. Some of it will be negotiated. Most of it will be unilaterally done because it has to be done for internal and other political reasons. I don't believe, by the way, in making return concessions for what the Soviets have just done. They've announced a troop cut for their own reasons. Remember when de Gaulle went to Russia in 1967, having just kicked NATO out of Paris? He went there expecting a big reward. And he got a handshake. Thanks, Charlie. Did the right thing. He's a very disappointed man. You don't pay people for doing what they have to do for themselves. That's my idea of negotiation. So, as long as we can keep clear on that, we can do some business with the Russians. Keep their respect that way, too.
Next question, Reed Johnson.
We enter the decade with each party, the United States and Soviet Union, with about 10,000 nuclear warheads apiece.
Right.
Would you like to project what you might find or we might find at the end of the decade in that area?
I think on both sides there will be substantially fewer warheads. You should realize that in addition, the inventories on our side now are substantially less capable in terms of yield and megatonnage. They're not the same thing, by the way, than they were years ago. We have about one quarter of the sort of the gross explosive force that we had in 1968. That's not a bad thing, and I'm not complaining because we know how to use it a whole lot better. But you should realize that we don't need, and the Soviets don't need, all that we have on the two sides. What we have got to work out is a way of getting rid of this stuff without undermining deterrence. That's the problem. I mean, I'd rather have good deterrence and high levels of nuclear stockpiles than lower levels of warheads and uncertainty as to whether or not somebody's going to do something stupid. So, you know, what this big minuet is about is how to keep everybody confident as we get rid of some of this stuff. I know personally, I've spent a lot of time with Soviet military people in the last 2 years, a lot of time. And I know that they've finally figured out they don't need it all. What they don't know is how to maintain their bureaucratic positions, for one thing. Now, think about this. Soviet forces, most of the nuclear weapons are controlled by the strategic rocket forces. So when you start talking about doing away with all kinds of this stuff, you are cutting directly at the heart of the bureaucracy. We have much more distributed nuclear posture in our forces, for good or for ill. One of the things it means is that at least nobody takes all the hit at once. When you talk about doing away with all the ICBMs or 50% of the available land-based warheads and that sort of stuff, the strategic rocket forces are looking at a drastic diminishment of budget, power, authority, resources, assets, importance, and all that sort of thing. Well, they've got to sort that out internally. It's going to take time. They don't want their forces to look like ours. They regard forces at sea, for example, as fundamentally not under full control. And we say, put more of your stuff to sea. You know, let's make it invulnerable. Let's both have small numbers of very invulnerable weapons. And they say, how fast can you communicate with your submarine commanders? How sure are you that he won't press the button? How much authority does he have? And they tell us right across the table like this, that you are not positively in control of your nuclear forces, and that is irresponsible. Now, I happen to disagree about their view of our responsibility in this matter, but you can understand that it's going to take a long time for the two sides to come, as I said earlier, to some shared understanding of how to do what needs to be done next. And I just think that We all need to help. We need to be patient, and that some of the arms control advocates in my town are taking a lot of cheap shots. It's very easy to say, "Hey, Do it now. 50%. But the modalities count. They count in diplomacy, they count in arms control negotiations, they count in strategic relations, they count in regional affairs. The modalities count. Old principle. You remember your line, I know. Nominus and consequentia reading. Names are the substance of the things. So what we call it is what it is. And so we're going to call it stability. But we're going to have to move real slow and cautiously just the same. And I all right, short answer is, yes, we can do without a lot of these things. I expect by the turn of the century we will have done away with quite a few of them. Although the demanufacture of nuclear weapons is technically a fairly challenging thing. And we have a little work to do in that area. But most of the work has to be done in a way that maintains an effective deterrent situation so that everybody has high confidence in this central strategic relationship so we can go on and deal with this stuff. That's the key.
Next question. Yes, Colonel Foster.
Just today on the radio we heard that there's been some progress made in controlling chemical weapons.
Yes.
What is your forecast for that to include nerve gas and biological weapons?
When I was in the arms control business, I had the responsibility, for my agency at least, for these things, and I've spent a great deal of time on this particular issue, and this guy sitting beside me helped me a lot. My projection is lots more states are going to have them. It's going to continue to be a problem. We can ban them all we want to, but the fact is you can take a pesticide factory and turn it around, not overnight, as you and I both know, but within a few weeks and do real interesting things with it. The problem with these agents is that it only takes a short period of time to manufacture militarily useful quantities. You know that. So the confidence factor is always going to be relatively low, in my view, in this sort of thing. I think declarations of principle are good and useful, and I think we ought to be in the business of establishing norms and setting the ground rules as best we can. I mean, even in war, people follow ground rules to some extent. Most wars have ground rules, even though an awful lot of violence is done. And if you're the guy on the ground and somebody's shooting at you, you may not feel like there are any, but generally speaking, states agree tacitly or explicitly on what the geographical boundaries are going to be, on whether or not special weapons are going to be employed, and on what they're going to do on the economic front. We kind of do this. So right now, we've had a pretty good record of success between the great powers and among the great powers in not using chemical weapons one against another. We have a lousy track record in preventing their use at all. And what worries me, and I hate once again to say it quite like this, but I told you I'd speak plainly. We've got a lot of countries now acquiring advanced weaponry of various sorts, including CW, that do not have good histories in these areas, that do not have good governmental institutions, that do not have internal norms that prevent them from resorting to things that we would consider barbarous or unuseful or simply stupid. And so my projection is lots of more countries are going to have them. We're going to see more use of it. It's going to be a continuing problem. The most hopeful thing that has happened is that in the last 5 days, the Soviets have agreed with us that this is a bad idea. We've been working for years to get them to come out to that position. I sat with Roland Timurbayev in New York in 1984. And he and I sat out in the lobby while the General Assembly was in session and talked about these things and where they were going to come down. He wanted to know what my position was going to be. And I wanted to know what his position was going to be. And we agreed then that somehow we had to find a way to cooperate to stop this. But the Soviet government, until very recently, was unable to admit, simply, publicly, that they were a major chemical weapons producer and power. And they were unable to admit and to deal with the fact that lots of other countries had acquired these things when they could have prevented it. So what we saw in the last week was, in my view, a step in the right direction, and it's something we can use. We and the Soviets can cooperate on something like this. We can keep the problem from being worse than it will be anyway. It is going to be bad.
Could you enlarge on the biological warfare side of that, please?
Genetic engineering is bringing hope to the human race and risks at the same time. We can make some real interesting bugs now. So can others. The bad part is that this can be done and that you can produce an awful lot of stuff in terms of its effects in a very, very short period of time, because these things grow fast, real fast. The good part is that it's fairly high tech, and very few outfits around can do it right now. And the third aspect I would just simply point to, which I think is also good, is that it's so dangerous. I don't think anybody in his right mind can let go of this stuff. The fourth point, very simply, and this is not good news, is that there are a lot of people out there not in their right minds. I want to keep that very clearly in view. We are not dealing with an entirely sane population out there in the world. So, yeah, BW is a threat. There are some new things, things we don't know how to protect against. We don't even know what the other side or some other entity is inventing, because the possibilities are so numerous. When you start manipulating biological material these days, you can do almost anything. So you can make things that work fast, that go through membranes, that go through clothing, that lie dormant for a few weeks and then make people sick. You can make things that survive in water but not in air, and vice versa. All these kinds of things, and it's just it's a very active field.
What is the best thing to try to keep that in check, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, we have an international agreement. Those hold up until somebody decides to go to war or commit some sort of nasty act. So, I mean, it's not as if they're worthless, but we have to keep affirming the norms. We have to keep doing our very best to support a reasonable, ethical approach to the resolution of conflicts. And I have no reluctance whatsoever to go to war. I've been there, I'll go again. But our role in times like this, it seems to me, our role being that of the United States, has to be to try to support a reasonable international order that has some rules, that has some limits, that has some obligations. And that's how you have a society of states.
What sort of diseases would they be able to produce?
Anything, anything you can think of. We know that the Soviets had a terrible accident at one of their facilities and had anthrax all over the place. That's been reported, so I feel comfortable mentioning it to you. A number of other examples that I not feel comfortable mentioning to you. But anything you can think of, anything from a cold to a flu to incapacitating nausea to bursting blood vessels to unbelievable overstimulation of your nervous system. There's no limit.
Professor Fernbach?
I'm much impressed with much of what you have to say, particularly the general approach to new strategy, and I have a whole bunch of questions, but I'll combine two of them that you've already touched on. You have to come back, of course, for all of us to what's going to happen to Japan.
Yes.
Threw that one out, and let me link it in with another point. In this relationship between economic and military power, the Japanese have demonstrated what you can do with the former.
Right.
But they've done it, haven't they, with R&D especially, and its capacity to put that research and development to practical usages, an area which we've slipped on to some degree. Mm. Would you comment on that in terms of the real factor of power, which is, I think, respect for R&D development on which we've been somewhat negligent, and of course the Russians too.
I'm glad you gave me a chance to come back to Japan for a moment. I didn't do justice to it in my opening remarks, but I was conscious that time was passing and there were a lot of interesting people in this room. Let me take the second part first, if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. I believe the idea of competitiveness has been much misunderstood and misused in the last couple of years. Partly it's used, I would say mostly it's used, to think about competitiveness in the sense of cost advantage. Can you make a car and sell it cheaper than the other guy? But you've touched on the heart of it. Because I think competitiveness ultimately resides in the effectiveness of your overall design, your understanding of the future, your planning, not just of R&D, but of other resources, to get to where you want to be. Now, that's what strategy is about. I used to teach strategy, believe it or not. You have to define your future, and you have to figure out how to get there. The Japanese have been very much better than we at defining where they want to be a few years later on. And we will be competitive when we start doing the same. And it has nothing to do with cost per se. It has nothing to do with whether or not the union movement is strong in the United States. It has nothing to do with whether or not we rebuild heavy industry. It has to do with defining where we want to be and then getting there. I do not believe that it is beyond the wit of man to do that in the United States. And I will not settle for less than that. As for your first part of your question, it has something to do with R&D. I'm not ignoring that part of your concern. I think the government made a colossal mistake a few years ago when it cut back drastically on tax credits for R&D for industry. But that mistake is being corrected. So I think that issue is over. Where is Japan going to be? Japan is going to be, as it is now, the world's second largest economy. It's going to have, now has the eighth largest military in the world. It's probably going to have about the fourth. The Japanese are going to be playing a much larger role in regional affairs. They're going to be distributing a great deal more aid. They're going to be more active politically than they've been before. They're going to continue to be, despite the size of the military, not very good at it. There are a small number of things that the Japanese do very, very well militarily, some of which involve cooperation with us, and almost all of which is extremely sensitive. But the fact is that the Japanese have, by design, made their military, however large and heavily funded it is, less good than it could be. They do not have an effective joint command operation. They do not practice combined arms. Their army, navy, and air force are independent, good enough at what they do by themselves, but they can't work together with. And it's just a shame to see our best friend in that part of the world I'm going to use an ugly Washington word, okay? They are sub-optimizing. Isn't that awful? And they know it. And all of the encouragement in the world from our side for them to do more and be better isn't going to matter as long as they have the political problems they have. So Japan is going to be, as I say, economically powerful, militarily large, marginally competent. In that sense, regionally more influential. And if we're not careful, politically more extreme. The worst thing we have to worry about, and Henry Kissinger has written about this recently in one of his syndicated columns, I'm sure you've all seen it, but I think he's exactly right. We have an abiding interest in encouraging Japanese politics to stay to the center. The Japanese go to the left, they're dangerous. If they go to the right, they're dangerous. and they have enough muscle, economically speaking and culturally speaking, for us to take that very, very seriously. So I don't care if the Liberal Democratic Party rules forever in Japan. There are a lot of people over here who criticize Japan because they say the LDC has been the party in power forever and ever and ever, and that means it's not a true democracy. Well, I can do without true democracy in Japan as long as the politics stay in the center. We just got to keep clearing our minds on some of these things and get away from the ideology. We don't need that. We need a very safe Japan. So do their neighbors. And our role in the Western Pacific, to a large part, depends on how people think we are helping to deal with Japan, how we are helping to deal with mainland China, how we are helping to keep the Korean thing from going on. That's where our influence resides, very much like the Eastern Mediterranean. Our influence in parts of the Arab world depends on the extent to which we keep the Israelis on leash, as they see it. We all know that the Israelis are not on leash, and it's very hard to manage. But in any case, our influence in some of these places depends to some extent on how well we play our role in dealing with some of the dangerous possibilities in these places. And I think Japan is key.
Other questions?
Yes, Howard Cromwell.
To what extent do you think the planning of conflict in the future will be associated with the location of strategic materials?
That's a good question. To some extent, our planning for at least 30 years, since the early 50s, I know, since I've read the plans, has taken that into account. If you mean, do I think that places like South Africa and the Persian Gulf are going to be continuing sources of potential conflict or risk? The answer is yes, but not necessarily because of what's there. These are volatile regions politically, not just valuable economically. And so you have a combination of external interest in the resources and internal problems that make them permanently unstable. South Africa is a nice place. It's a wonderful country. Not by its politics, but I mean its geography and all that's there. The Persian Gulf is miserable. Frankly, if I had to live there all the time, I'd be pretty mean too. I learned one rule in Bahrain. Nobody beats the emirs racing camels.
We really have to always keep our guard up about, otherwise, and that is their enormous intelligence system, gathering, organizing, classifying, and then using. Going way back to Tsarist times, we could never do anything like that politically. But that's the way they've been running, the way they've been kept moving. At least I would think in large part is what has made the Soviet Union always a totally reliable, stable country. In that sense, by their economic troubles. But it would, I think, also mean that any rapprochement for stability between the two of us is always something that's subject to the risk of things changing quite suddenly.
I take your point. I'd like to respond to two of the things that you touched on, the intelligence thing and the stability point. Stability first. I know of no rule of statecraft that says that two absolutely unqualified enemies can't have a stable relationship. We have a lot of evidence on the record that states can be enemies for centuries without really fooling with each other too much, because it's dangerous and things. And in this period with particularly deterrent situation and other possibilities, it's very dangerous. So I'm not real worried about stability as a substitute for a wary relationship. And please don't mistake me on that. I'm not talking about detente, and I'm not talking about friendship. I'm talking about ground rules. We understand each other well enough to know what we're going to do and what we're not, and what's dangerous and what's not. And that where we can cooperate, we will. And there are issues emerging on which we can cooperate. They need our help when things like the Chernobyl thing goes down. I was there 3 weeks after Chernobyl. And by the way, I did eat the cucumbers and tomatoes. Not the ice cream. We can work on that without ever giving up what I think we have to have as a permanently vigilant concern and an awareness that they are not really our friends. But we don't need them as a friend. We need them not to be doing bad things while we're not looking. So all I'm interested in is getting the rules of the road straightened out to the point, not where we don't look, but where we both understand it. All right? The intelligence thing is of concern for one reason only. The Soviets have over and over again gotten smarter, faster, in a lot of technical and other areas than they could have on their own because they've been able to collect it or buy it from us or somebody else. We should never underestimate what they're doing. I'll give you a small example of classic strategic misjudgment, and it's discussed in there, by the way. So it's open now, and we can talk about this. This is classified for a long time. When NATO adopted nuclear weapons and strategy in the early years, there was an explicit assumption that the Soviets would not be able to field tactical nuclear weapons in significant numbers for a long period of time. In point of fact, they did so within months after we fielded tactical nuclear weapons in Europe in 1954. It was one of the great strategic surprises of the early Cold War. How did this happen? It happened because we were using gaseous diffusion cascades in Oak Ridge to enrich weapons material. And we knew how much electricity that required. We did not have good information on what was going on inside Soviet weapons plants, but we had a way, which I won't tell you how, but we had a way of assessing how much electricity was being used. So we did the ordinary arithmetic and came to the conclusion that they couldn't be doing very much because of the power levels that were being consumed there. Turns out they were using a centrifuge to enrich their nuclear material to weapons grade. It takes roughly 10% of the electricity to use a centrifuge as it does to run a gaseous diffusion cascade. So we were off by at least 10 times, in other words, an order of magnitude, on our judgment of what they could do and how fast they could do it. Now, I tell you that story simply to make the point that I take very seriously Soviet intelligence capabilities, not because I'm worried about spy stories and all the stuff you see in the novels, but because it has a great deal to do with the technical edge and the technological edge on which we count so much for our comparative advantage over the coming years. And we cannot afford to ignore that. So we just have to pay attention. We have to do the best we can. And we have to realize at the same time that they're going to steal as much as they can, buy what they can, and develop only what they must.
Other questions?
I'm interested in your word caution, because as you well know, the Russians have gone from a local defense force to a one of the largest military forces, naval forces in history.
Right.
Obviously offensive. And the basic concept of communism certainly hasn't changed. I had with all the euphoria around Gorbachev and whatnot, I haven't heard anybody say that the basic concept has changed. So I'm concerned about how we move, I'd be interested in your comments on how we move in with any confidence that they are not going to try to beat us to the gun in these third countries.
Right.
Third countries that we're concerned about and on other fronts. When we know that their basic concept is aggression, is an offensive move now.
I have a couple of responses to that. I guess the first thing I would say is that the Soviets have so much trouble at home right now that I don't even think they can pull the gun, much less beat us to it. Second, in a time of severe underperformance of the Soviet economy, what they're looking for is the divestiture of regional responsibilities, not the addition to them. One of the things I would be willing to bet is that before the turn of the century, we're going to see a major change in the structure of Soviet economic support for Cuba, Angola, Vietnam, countries like this. They can't afford it. Moreover, they're not getting anything back. So I really think that we're in for some major changes in that area, and we ought to encourage it all we can. We ought to shut up. You know, here is a case where silence and integrity really can work for you, okay? Let's make it easy for them to do what they have to do. Let's not insult them. Let's not call attention to it unduly. Let's make it easy for them quietly to steal away from these draining, wasting assets in various regions. Because I think they have to.
As they have in Afghanistan.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think we've probably celebrated a little bit too much on that. I understand taking political credit, and all politicians have to do that. Thank God I'm not a politician. I'm not as other men are. I don't mean to sound like a Pharisee, but I do mean to say that it is difficult in politics not to take credit for some of these things, whether you deserve it or not. But the best thing we can do for the next few years is to shut up and let them make the adjustments to their situation that they must make for their own reasons. And let them make them for their own reasons. Let's not take all the credit. Let's not demand that the world believe that we forced them out of here and forced them out of there. Just let them go. They will. As for the structure of their naval forces, the Soviets really love me because I'm on the record and in print about the Black Sea Fleet and the Mediterranean Squadron when they sortie. I wrote a few years ago and was roundly denounced for it when I was last in Moscow, that in the event of war, the Soviet Black Sea Fleet and Mediterranean Squadron, so what I said, word for word, would have a short but exciting life. I believe that to be true.
They've said the same thing about the Sixth Fleet, I think.
They've said it, but they're wrong. I did a lot of work on our planning in that part of the world in the early 80s and was part of, you recall when Jimmy Holloway was CNO, he said that we could not stay in the Eastern Mediterranean in the event of conflict. And so we developed this whole Central and West Med fallback and then, you know, extended plans for inching our way back the other way. Well, I'm one of the guys who in 82 and 83 said, bullshit. We can stay there and we figured out how to do it. And what I'll tell you, you know when things are going to get tight in the Middle East because the Soviet fleet runs for the Black Sea, they don't come out. They know. They trotted out Admiral Lemelko for me a little while ago. Brought him to Washington. I don't know if you recall who he was. He was Ike Kidd's counterpart in the 73 crisis in the East Med. He's a fairly well up in years now, and they call him an inspector general in the defense ministry. Basically, they're keeping him on active duty and full pay as a kind of a reward for his long service and all that sort of thing. But I spent a day with him, and we talked about all kinds of stuff in his career, and we talked about that crisis and all that sort of stuff. And he said, the whole day was worth one line. He said, I didn't think it was a crisis. And it just confirms what I'm saying. If they really think there's a crisis, they're going to run like hell. Because we'll kill them. Here I kid side of it. I said, well, I had to get on the horn and talk to this guy across the water because he wasn't responding to radio signals and all this sort of stuff. You know, they're just totally different stories. Same events. But you got to try to put these things together, give them a context. And all I can say is that I make these small points about the East Med to make a large point about your question. I do not worry about the offensive capability of the Soviet Navy. I believe we can deal with it. As far as I can tell, they're going to spend most of their time in home waters. And the only thing they have to worry about when they try to close the straits into the Sea of Okhotsk. I'm sorry. Talking shorthand, and I shouldn't be. Is whether we're already in there. We will be.
Fitting that the Vice President for Health Affairs asked the last question.
Well, I hesitate. I want to ask you, you've made a very good case for me, at least, that it's very unlikely that the Russians are about to unleash something on us. One.
Right.
Two, they're not about to try to take over the Third World. They
right.
can't afford to. What are our real concerns about what they may do that we've got to be really on guard about in the real world?
Okay. First of all, if we don't hold our own with them and aren't perceived to be holding our own with them, the basic structure of deterrence could be eroded. We have to care about that. That is a permanent concern. Second, we are facing political trends, not just in Asia and not just in the Third World, but in Europe, that could be very adverse for us. And the Soviets are willing to take advantage of these things and to accelerate them. We do not want to see our closest associations, our best friends, our democracies, however durable, however fragile, falling apart and being assisted in doing so by the Soviets. Third, we do not want to see our structure of alliances and arrangements disintegrate. And the Soviets have a strong interest in having that happen, however they can help it along. And I don't think they're going to take any risks to do it. But if we don't do our part, they sure will help. Fourth, the Soviets are, in fact, a very big and rich country. They have a lousy management structure over there, and it's a terrible shame, but we can't count on them being permanently incompetent. So we need to be thinking about how Soviet assets are going to come into play as the world economy evolves into the 21st century. They are already applying, as you know, for observer status at the IMF. They're talking about trying to get involved in the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. Actually, I hope they do. Maybe we can get out and they can have all the problems. They're thinking in the long term about having a convertible currency. They're not ready to do that yet, and they're right, they can't possibly risk it at the moment. What I'm saying is they're trying to join the world economy. You know, when I talk
to... We want them to, but we don't want them to. I mean,
some do and some don't.
What am I hearing from you?
All right, what you're hearing from me is, I just as soon have them in, but I'm not so sure I want to see a stronger Soviet Union. So I don't think the two necessarily equate. And I think it's in our interest to figure out how to make sure that they don't.
You don't believe that being a little stronger, they'll feel more secure and be less aggressive. You think that's bullshit, as you put it?
I've never believed in helping your enemy to get stronger. Well, I have a fundamental logical problem with that. They're certainly not our friend. Okay? And the last thing I would list that is of concern, we do need from them a degree of cooperation in managing some of these regional issues that are emerging. There is, whether we like it or not, an agenda, partly regional, partly global, on which we, they, and others have to work together or nothing will get done. So that's my answer.
Norman, Tommy should be last, but on most things I think you agree there. I wonder if there are a few things where you disagree.
I haven't heard anything with which I disagree.
Well, then we
and
should.
Let me just pose one simple question here, and that is, as you described the probable changes in the military structures of both this country and the USSR, it seems to me that we're moving in the direction of trying to be a bit more efficient in fighting small wars, but in the process reducing our capacity to fight a big war. So does that mean then that you assume that we and the Russians together are simply discounting the possibility of a major war?
I'll answer in two ways. When I talk to the Soviets about these kinds of things, which I do regularly, their list of concerns as to how a war might start goes like this. War by inadvertence. Somebody does something dumb and both sides' indications and warning systems spin up and somebody pushes a button and something goes. Number two, escalation from a regional crisis. And one reason that I think they're going to be so very, very careful about military involvement in regional affairs is that they recognize that the risk is very high that these things could get out of hand. Number three, interestingly enough, and this was a real surprise to me in my next set of discussions, they talked about third world debt as a possible trigger for war. Now, the way they put it, this is like 1946, you know, when they offered us the chance to give them a great big loan so as to save our economy. Their formal argument is that we're so exposed that we're likely to do something very bad in dealing with this sort of thing. The fact is they're exposed too, and they're worried about it. They don't know what to do about it. They've got a lot of uncollectible debts, and they're carrying client states that they can't afford, and it's on their minds. But to have that show up as number three on their list of triggers for war was extremely telling, as far as I'm concerned. And I'd have to tell you, I reported that immediately when I returned because I thought that mattered. Generally speaking, the Soviets at this point do not think war with us is a good idea. I know the Soviet leadership feels that way. I think the Soviet military generally agrees, although they're worried about the consequences of arms cuts, partly for the bureaucratic reasons that I mentioned earlier. So, the answer to your question very simply is, we and the Soviets have come to an understanding, I think, that war between us would be a real bad idea in the foreseeable future. We've come to a related understanding that we can probably do quite well with much smaller nuclear inventories. And we are beginning to understand that if we don't cooperate on dealing with some of these regional problems, we are running risks that neither side wants to run. But again, the modalities count. You gotta feel your way step by step. You're a diplomatist and a diplomatic historian, you know exactly what that involves. It takes a long time, it's delicate, sometimes confusing because people don't always say what they mean. Confucius, can I conclude with one more line? Confucius said something I really like. And Clausewitz echoed it many years later. Confucius said, if there could be only one law, mine would be to call things by their right name. The most important thing we can do in the next few years, as between us and the Soviets and as amongst ourselves, is to call things by their right name. Tell the truth. If it's a problem, it's a problem. If it's a condition, it's a condition. You know the difference, don't you? Problems have solutions. Conditions simply are conditions. Very important, logically speaking. So I just think we have to get clear on these things. And the more we can do with them, good. The more we can do with our allies, good. You have to remember, by the way, an ally is not always a friend, as we've just found out in Paris. And we'll just have to press on through.
This is meant as a compliment. I had a good friend in New York who used to say, I may be wrong, but I'm never in doubt. I used to envy him for a long, long time, and then I realized that because he did say what he thought, I learned a great deal from him. I think we've learned a great deal today, and we hope that Dr. Edsel will come back and teach us some more.